we're going to continue with Ecclesiastes, and I would like to kind of finish up tonight. What I'd like to take up, I don't believe I took up one of the lifestyles, I think, which is an important one. You know, the Torah deals with every lifestyle, and Ecclesiastes, when I say the Torah, I mean the Tanakh, in other words, the words of the prophets, and the Torah deal with every kind of lifestyle. And one of them, which is probably in our society, certainly very prevalent, is the romantic one. And that is the person who lives for romantic love. But I don't mean a person that has a good marriage. That's a quiet kind of a enjoyment. I'm talking about the love affair and the passionate kind of love situation. Many times people are happily married, and especially what people call the middle age crisis, people start searching around for the passionate love. And that is, for some people, that is the essence of their existence, to experience this this kind of powerful pleasure and enjoyment. So I just wanted to mention that King Solomon has that there too, and that is in 726. And it's interesting to see how he expresses himself about that. He says over there, and I have found more bitter than death the woman. And over here, the woman, see, if no, when it says the woman could be one of two things. It could either be the instinctual drives, or else it could be Torah. And this is throughout the prophets. It's interesting why that is chosen. Sometimes the woman refers to Torah. Sometimes the woman refers to the instincts, the instinctual life, which is considered as wrong and as evil. And yet sometimes the word woman, and we'll get to that soon, refers to the best life, which is the Torah. And I'll explain to you why it is that way. It's based on a very deep psychological principle. But let's just assume that for a moment. Now, here he's talking about the passionate kind of life. And by the way, when he says the woman, he means the passionate love. It doesn't matter whether it's from the man's side or the woman's side. He is speaking, of course, being a man from the man's side, but the same is true from the woman's side. Okay? So he says the passionate romantic life, he says, I found worse than death. And he says, because her heart, meaning this is the case of the evil woman's heart, is captivating, and her hands are like bonds. And he says, it is good before God that one should escape from her, and a sinner will be captured by her. Okay? So, of course, this is one verse, and, we have to just try to get to the nucleus of what King Solomon is trying to teach us here. Why does King Solomon say that the life of passionate love, and there are people, certainly in our society, we see it all the time, especially with the famous people that everybody watches, the Hollywood people. This is the very essence of their life. I mean, one romance after another, things get dull, time for another romance, time for another affair. This is their life. And as I said, Torah doesn't degrade lifestyles. It analyzes them and explains to you rationally what's wrong with them. Now, in this case, King Solomon is pointing to something here, and he's explaining why that kind of lifestyle cannot be a happy one. Okay, what is the reason? Well, the reason obviously is in his choice of words that characterize this kind of a lifestyle, and his choice of words essentially are captivating, tied and bonds, can't escape. That's why he says a good person will escape from such a situation. What King Solomon is saying over here is that in the powerful grips of a passionate love relationship, the person has no freedom, and the person is swallowed up in a situation where they are in bondage because they must act in a certain way, in a certain way only, and that is in a way which will please the person that they are romantically attached to. So therefore, King Solomon says that such a life can never be happy because because it's not a free life. He's captured. He's considered like he's like a net, like an animal that's caught in a net. What he means to say is that any life that's not free, where the person is completely under compulsion and restraint, and the person is forced to live a certain way, their essential preoccupation is what the love object thinks of them. This certainly cannot be a good life, because it is, the person has no freedom. The good life must always be a free life. And in this respect, I mean, he would agree with Sigmund Freud's psychological analysis of the love situation, where he states that the state of being in love is really very similar to the state of neuroses. And neuroses is characterized by compulsion, and the same thing is true of the passionate love situation. So neuroses is not a happy state of mind. Neurosis is a state where a person loses their freedom, their psychological freedom. So in this respect, King Solomon's analysis of the situation is really pretty close to Sigmund Freud's analysis of the love situation. Of course, as I mentioned before, this does not mean, is not referring to a happy marriage. Happy marriage is always considered a good. This is referring to the person that is not satisfied with a happy marriage, the quiet happy marriage, but is looking for the passionate, powerful emotional experience of love. Okay, I just thought I'd mention that because, as I said before, I mean, you know, the Torah does not look down, simply say things are prohibited. The Torah analyzes every kind of lifestyle and doesn't look down on anything and say this is not worthy of analysis. We have to, something, we just can't say it's prohibited. We have to understand what is wrong with it, and if it's wrong, it has to be unhappy, and you have to understand why it is so. Okay, now, what I would like to do is just to try to get, we have the problem is pretty clear. The problem is that there is no real lifestyle that a person can adopt in which he can be happy, for the simple reason that the moment you put your faith in any kind of a situation, your mind tells you immediately that things do not have to work out the way you wish them to, and therefore you're in conflict, and therefore you cannot be happy. So the question, of course, is there any lifestyle? And that's what King Solomon says, that he says everything is vanity. Vain means empty and simply not worthy of human striving. Oh, so that's the question he presents. Now, is there an answer? That's extremely important. In truth, there is an answer. There is no doubt, because King Solomon in Ecclesiastes does give advice. He does say, do this, do that. Now, obviously, when he's giving advice, then this is the answer. He's expecting you to realize that when he's saying that this is something which is good, he's recommending something, giving his recommendation, he's expecting you to realize that therein lies the answer. But, of course, as it is always in the Torah and the prophets, it is, you know, you have to seek it out. It's not just given to you on a silver platter. So what I'd like to do tonight is to construct the answer that King Solomon has for the human dilemma of life. Now, let's just, there are a few aspects to it. What I'd like to do is, let me just give one more example of a deprecated lifestyle that he shows is false. Again, it's important to have the false in your mind, so then you'll be able to contrast the true. And that's the whole style of here, and that's why it looks like contradictions. But it's not contradictions, it's opposing opinions or opposing ideas. Now let's take a look for a moment at 8:10, okay? This is a difficult verse at first sight, where he says, and so I have seen wicked people that are buried, and they come forth. Okay, and then he says, and from a holy place they come, and it will be forgotten in the city that which they do. Okay, and this too, he says, is empty. All right, now let me explain to you, if you just literally translate the words, it doesn't seem to make any sense. again, I'm going to resort to the benefit that we have of the scholars of Israel who had the true tradition of what the meaning of the verses are. This is the way they explain it. They explain it like this, that when it says that he saw wicked people buried and then they came forth, I don't know what your translation is, but I'm just giving you the literal translation. I have seen wicked people buried and they came forth. What does this mean? Okay. What it means is that he's talking about life, and he's saying that people that are wicked during their lifetime, they're corrupt individuals, and we all are familiar with such individuals. They're corrupt individuals in our society. Many times they're great, known as great philanthropists. But, you know, because they make a lot of money, oftentimes in a dishonest way, and those who are close to them know what they really are. But then when they have a lot of money, they make big donations, and people think, oh, these are great people, okay? What he's saying here is a very similar thing. He's saying the wicked people that are buried, I saw them come forth, which means many times people live a wicked life. They can amass large sums of money, and then their children will come forth and will, you know, will buy a big plaque for them in the synagogue or some other place where people will praise them. So what King Solomon is saying is that a lot of times people think, well, you know, maybe a person can get away with something during a lifetime, but, you know, truth will out. In other words, in the end, people are going to see that this person was false. Not so, says King Solomon. He says, don't even hope for that, because he says many times people are wicked and crooked, distorted, corrupt during their lifetimes, and yet their children, who are often, I'm just giving you an example, often people of means, they come forth, they set up these big memorials for these people, and these people go down in history as great people. So he says, don't even hope. A lot of times people think, well, you know, in the back of their mind, it pays to be virtuous because in the end people will know. King Solomon says, oh, no, no, if you're relying on that, you're making a mistake again. And that's the point of the whole Ecclesiastes, is to show how people fool themselves with these ideas during their lifetime, and when you analyze them, they are not true. So he says that the, you know, there's two ways to interpret the rest of the verse, but they're both the way the rabbis interpret it or the way Ibn Ezra gives a more literal interpretation, but it's the same idea. The concept is that oftentimes the righteous person, the person that really is coming from a holy place, is forgotten. And he dies, perhaps he didn't have any children, and the good deeds that he does are simply forgotten forever. So what King Solomon is saying here again is he's disclosing another illusion, the illusions of man. The vain and empty things that King Solomon is talking about is all the illusions that man places before his mind's eye in order to get him through this life in a way that's satisfying, in a way that leads him, that gives him courage to live a good life. So King Solomon is not... doesn't want you to be fooled by that. He doesn't want you to do the good because of a false reason either. We do not believe in the Torah does not believe in the righteous lie. That was really a Gentile invention. But the Torah believes in the truth, and the Torah doesn't even want you to do the good if you have a false illusion about it. And he discloses the illusion. Many people are righteous because they think that in the end people are going to know the truth. No. Don't rely on that one. That doesn't work out either. That's just another illusion. And that's why King Solomon is disclosing that one over there. Okay, I just wanted to take one more example. I mean, there are many, as I said, there are many, many examples of the illusions that he breaks, you know, the illusions of man that he breaks throughout the book. I would recommend, if anybody wants to pursue this further, and it is a beautiful, beautiful topic, the best commentary is Rashi, because now that you have you should have by now an approach to the book. Once you have the approach to the book, then the details are not so difficult. So if you want to pursue this further, I would strongly suggest that you read through the book, but with the interpretation of Rashi, because Rashi brings the closest interpretation to the scholars, which have the true tradition of the correct interpretation of Kabbalah. So if you're going to choose one interpretation, I would choose Rashi. Ibn Ezra is great, of course. It's a little more philosophical, but I mean, as a first choice, Rashi is indispensable. Okay, as a beginning, you cannot do without Rashi. So at any rate, getting back to this, so that there is another case of an illusion. Now, the question is, when all these illusions, most people really are righteous for reasons that are illusions. I mean, they comfort themselves during their lifetimes. They say, well, you know, I'm losing out, but it's better to be honest for this reason and that reason. It's better to be good. And that's basically what King Solomon shows, that all these reasons really fall apart when you analyze them. Okay. Now, let's get back to the point that I mentioned before. What is the good life? Is there really any kind of life that that man can live that makes him happy? I mean, that's a problem. So a person is a psychological being. He has to be happy. If he's not going to be happy, he can't function properly. Okay. Let's take a look at an interesting verse here, which you have to you have to be very alert here and pick up on when he's when he's pointing to the answer. Okay, take a look at verse 8:1. Okay, he says, "Who is like the wise man, and who knows how to interpret a thing? The wisdom of a man lights up his face, and the strength of his countenance is different." Okay, now over here, you see the way he says that. He's making a statement. He's not making a statement. It's like a statement of awe, you know. Who is like the wise man? Who can give understanding and knowledge? What kind of statement is he saying? Is good? Is bad? Before he said, hey, you're a wise man, doesn't matter. You're gonna die just like a fool. You're gonna die just like an animal. So what good is it if you think that because you're wise, you're special and different and separate? That's just another illusion. He broke down that whole concept of the life of a great person. Okay, the great person really, if he thinks about the fact that he's going to die like an animal, it kind of removes that whole idea of greatness. But here he says, no. Here he says, he's in awe of the wise man. This is a statement of awe, an exclamatory statement. What does he mean by this? What he means is. What he means to say is that there is a part of man that really does not care about rewards, is not concerned about benefit, is not concerned about gain, doesn't even think about the self, but is just awed. That awe really expresses itself among human beings in the greatest way when it comes to wisdom. That's what he's saying. He's saying, in other words, that the wisdom is one thing that a person cannot talk away. I was watching a show the other night where they had a biography of a famous film star. And they asked the person about his life. So they said, well, he's older now. He's really approaching death. I mean, he's pretty old. And he says, well, my life was wine, woman, and song. What more is there to say about it? So when he was young and he had all these pleasures and these enjoyments, he was, very enthralled by them. But now when he looks back at them, he says, he's an honest person. There's nothing much to talk about my life. That's about it. But there's one thing. Pleasure could be talked away. Man, because man down deep recognizes that pleasure is a momentary kind of experience, or it has no real value. Like King Solomon says in Ecclesiastes, he says, and happiness, he says, what does it do for you? It does nothing, okay? So you had a moment of happiness. What happens the next day? You have nothing. But wisdom, he says, that is something man cannot talk away. When an individual sees a wise person, he's awed, he's inspired. Who is like the wise man? An exclamatory statement. What he's trying to say is that here we see the soul of man, the essence of man, what the Torah calls the divine element in man, moved. It's being moved. It says, and you see even in the world, I mean, you see in Albert Einstein how respected he is even after his death, and how people recognize this was a wise man. Here is intelligence. You can't talk that away. That's something you can't say, well, it's nothing. I mean, it's something which strikes a chord in the divine element of the human soul. So here King Solomon is moving towards an answer. What he's saying is, let's forget about why we do things for a moment. If you want to have the true life, you must look for the element in man that is awestruck by something truly great. And when the person is in that state of awe, he doesn't really care about anything. It's just, he doesn't even know why. Why do you recognize the great man, the great mind? Why? Not because he can produce any inventions. Not because he's a practical thinker. Not because of anything you can derive from him, but simply, it's an awesome phenomena. Okay? Here we see man is drawn naturally towards something great. So what King Solomon is saying now, he's putting together piecemeal the truly good life. And what he's saying over here is that the first thing we have to do if we look for the good life is we have to find something which is intrinsically valuable, something which gives man, which draws him in an intrinsic way for no external reason. That's why it's a totally exclamatory statement. Who is like the wise man? And who knows how to interpret something? How beautiful it is when we see a wise person take a part of reality and interpret it and explain it and show us how it works. That's a beautiful experience. Then we look at that person and we say, wow, look how that individual is capable of understanding the in-depth ideas behind the superficial, meaningless and unintelligible kind of phenomena. That is something which reaches deep down into the soul of man. And that's why he says the wisdom of a person lightens up his face. He looks different. His appearance is different. And I don't know if I can explain it, but I can only say that I have certainly experienced it. I studied under three of the greatest scholars of Israel, Rabbi Aaron Cutler, Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Rabbi Feinstein. And they're, I don't know, I probably, you wouldn't say that they were handsome people in a classical sense, but that light in their face, in their eyes, was amazing. It was like you could just see, it's a different kind of countenance, different kind of a face. And the essence of the personality is lit up with the wisdom and the knowledge. And the flashing eyes and the look. I mean, it's a hard thing to describe, but it is something which is there because the personality is alive on a different level. It's not a physical beauty. You can see sometimes a person that has perfect features and a classical sense of beauty, and there's a dullness. It's not alive. And then you see a person who isn't really handsome, but the inside the spark is evident. And the wisdom is something which actually causes the individual to the energy level to work in a totally different way, and one can see this from as an observer. That's what King Solomon is stating. You could see from the face that the inner life of this person is on a different energy wavelength. It's functioning differently. And the ideas are constantly, the mind is constantly moving, thinking of possibilities, ideas. That's where he says that the face is lit up. And then he says, and the strength of his countenance is different. Over here, by countenance, it means the part of a person that faces reality, and the way he acts is totally different. Most people act because they try to imitate certain models in their mind. They say, well, how would a person act in this situation? I'll act this way. They have certain models that they're imitating in different situations called to their mind certain individuals or certain models of action which they try to imitate or to put themselves in a certain type of a gear, you know, for this type of situation. But that's not the wise man. The wise person is totally different. Everything is new, and everything is determined purely by reason. He doesn't follow any kind of modes of behavior. The modes of behavior that the world sets forth for various situations are meaningless to him. His countenance, he faces reality with only one thing, with wisdom and knowledge. And everything is fresh when he looks at it, and he just uses his reasoning ability and acts according to what his reason dictates in the given situation. It's a different kind of facing of reality. That's what it means by the strength of his countenance. The countenance means that's that part of man that faces reality, that encounters reality. So that's what King Solomon is saying in this verse. He's summing up the awesomeness of wisdom and the person who is the one that is the owner, who possesses this wisdom, the possessor of the wisdom. Okay. So here we get a clue as to what he would consider the correct life and the good life. That is, it has to be an attraction to wisdom, not because of the fact that if you are wise, you're going to be respected. It's not like the world has a respect for a great professor, you know, like you imagine in your mind, you know, this. Maybe sometimes people get drawn to that idea. Like people often say, well, when you're young, it's good to be an athlete. When you're older, it's good to be a philosopher, you know, because they have images in their mind. But the image, of course, of greatness, he destroys, because he says death is the destruction of that. But the attraction to wisdom for its own sake, that one cannot deny. Wisdom cannot be, you can't talk away wisdom, and you cannot talk away a wise man. So there we're reaching deep down into the personality. That is certainly a major ingredient, or the major ingredient in his answer. Okay, now we'll move on a little bit more, and that's with regard to appreciation of wisdom per se, which is, the as I said, a major component. But now let's take a look at another thing. You see, again, if you take a look at verse 5 and 8, around 8, 7, 8, he starts giving out the answer. He says, take a look at verse 5. He says, he who keeps the commandment, he says, does not know of anything evil. He says, he says in another place that it won't help you, that the evil will be for you. It will be for you no matter what, because he says that, for instance, in 8:12, he says an evil person can live for a long time, okay? But over here he says no. He says that a person that keeps the mitzvah will not know of any evil. He says, and a time and judgment the heart of the wise man knows. What he means is, and then in another place, where justice just doesn't prevail. When we look around, we can't, you can't experimentally show justice. The answer is like this. The answer is, he is showing us that to do justice because of externals is not the life of illusion. But to understand justice, he says, justice is understood by the heart of the wise man. He means the wise man knows why the just life has to be the good life, okay? He does it because logically he knows this is the good life. Let me explain that just through an example. What he means is that, let us say you were in a situation where you were in an uncivilized country and you're exposed to all kinds of diseases. Now, on the one hand, you'll say, if you have recourse to modern medicine, you'll say, well, certainly you're going to use that. But if you're going to think that modern medicine is going to save you, I could show you that it's not necessarily true, that in spite of your inoculations and in spite of all the precautions you take, people still do die in that situation. So if you're doing it because you think this is a foolproof method of saving yourself, that's false. But if you do it because logic dictates that this is the correct way, my analogy is not exact, I'm just using it as an analogy. But if you do it because logic in your mind dictates that this is the correct thing to do, then you're being moved by something else. You're being moved by knowledge, because knowledge dictates that this is the healthy life. So what he's saying is, that when you know why the life of justice, why the just man's soul is in harmony, and why the wicked man's soul is in disharmony, then you know and you understand what justice is, and you're moved towards the just life for its own sake. Because this must be, you understand that this is the correct life of man. So what he's saying is that the correct life is based upon an intrinsic knowledge of what is good. And once you have a knowledge of what is good, and you know, in other words, if a person, for instance, understands the human soul and knows that the human soul could be in disharmony, then he studies the Torah life and he sees that in this case, if the person is drawn to the ideas, his life is in harmony, his soul is in harmony, he knows that this is true, then he knows that the righteous must have their reward simply because the way the condition of their soul is what gives them the reward. If a person, now the person might die tomorrow, that's true. There's nothing out there that's going to say that if your soul is in harmony, you're not going to have a mishap. There's no guarantee for that. The Torah never, ever gives a guarantee to anybody on anything like that. The best example, of course, is the life of Jacob. Look at the life. No one's going to be more righteous than Jacob. And Jacob had a very, very difficult life. He had 20 years working under Laban. Then he made the money. He had the success. Next thing he knows, he has to face Esau, who's about to kill him. He gets out of that. His daughter is raped. He gets out of that. The wife that he loved, Rachel, dies. And then after that happens, then what happens is his favorite son is presumed dead. So this is the most righteous of men. So the Torah never says that if you're righteous, you're going to be guaranteed a good life. That is not what Torah is all about. But Torah does say that if you understand what is good, and you understand what a harmonious soul is, and how when you live according to Torah, the soul is in harmony, then you'll have to do it because that is the only thing to do. That's the only rational thing to do. And that state of the soul, where the soul is in harmony, is the greatest reward in itself. That is the reward, to have such an existence. What God has in store for you in your life in terms of individual events, that is not the thing that should move a person. If you want to try to do that, that's where he says you're just going to be living in illusion, because every single type of guarantee or security that you have in your life can be broken down. And the only way you could live that kind of a life is by denying the reality and the possibility of the breakdown, which means that you are of necessity in conflict and you must be unhappy. That is King Solomon's point. So King Solomon is saying that the only way to comprehend justice is to understand the perfection of the soul and why the soul is in harmony when it lives the Torah life. Okay, let's take a look again at 8:12, where he says over there that he says the sinner can do evil hundreds of times and have a lengthy life. And then he says in the very same verse, but I also know that it will be good for those that fear God. And in the next verse he said, and good shall not be for the wicked, and he will not have lengthy days. He'll be like a shadow. Okay? So what does he mean? He means, it sounds like a contradiction in the same verses. What he's saying is, it depends. If you're looking at the externals, at external events, if that's what your ethical system is based on, then you're just fooling yourself. The evil man can be very successful and can have a very lengthy days physically, yes. But in terms of a harmonious soul, that's impossible. So that's why he says, and I know, he says, that the evil man will not have lengthy days, meaning to say any days of lengthy days in terms of quality. He's physically alive, but what good is life? Life is only good if a person is in a happy state. And since he has no happiness, his day is like nothing. It's like his entire life is like a shadow in terms of the good times in his life pass like a shadow. They're practically nil. So there, he's showing you that the only kind of life that can give man worthwhile existence is not based upon the externals and the events. The events, God doesn't guarantee anything that has to do with events. All he tells us is, he teaches us what is intrinsically, logically, the happiest life and the state in which the soul experiences the greatest joy, and that's through the knowledge of Torah. So there's where he's making inroads already into what the proper life is. But there are a few points that are left which are extremely important. At this point, I'd just like to mention what I said before. Why in the prophets you always have the woman is used in two different ways. One way is the evil way, which means the evil woman, which refers to the instinctual life. And the other way, the same idea of a woman, is used to represent the greatest life, and that is the life of Torah. And the reason for that is because the psychology of Torah, as I may have mentioned this before, the psychology of Torah is that it's the same energy source that can be used for the instinctual, which through knowledge is diverted to another course where it is used for knowledge. So that's why the parable that the prophet uses is the same thing. He uses a woman, but there's good and there's bad. Meaning to say that this same energy, which can be directed towards the evil, towards the instinctual, can also be directed, the very same energy can also be directed towards the highest life, which is the life of pursuit of knowledge of Torah and knowledge of God. So that is why it's extremely important that the prophet chose that, because what the prophet is saying is it's the same energy source. This psychology crops up a lot in Torah, that the same energy source can be used for both. And the Torah believes that a very evil person also has the capacity to be a very righteous person. It's just that the energy is being directed in the wrong path. It cannot get out of the instinctual. But if that person could remove himself or herself from the instinctual life, they would be able to be extremely righteous. There's such a thing as a great soul, a very evil person, a person who is it cannot be just a nobody. It's not an average person. It shows that the soul has some kind of greatness to it. It's a high energy soul, but it depends where the energy is traveling. If it's traveling to the instinctual, then they will be a great evil person. Whereas if it's traveling towards if it's rerouted and directed towards Torah and towards knowledge, the person will be a great person. That's why I use the same example as mentioned before of the woman, and that's a part of the answer over here as well, where he's trying to show you what the good life is. Now, the good life has to be the life in which the energies of man is consumed. Because if you don't consume energy, then you're not going to have a good life. Then you'll be frustrated. Most people find that the greatest difficulty in life is they have nothing to do. Why do they have nothing to do? They're bored, especially people that retire. They find that the greatest danger they face is nothingness. In other words, they have to constantly be doing something. Just spoke to a relative of mine that retired, and they said the most important thing for them is not to be alone at nighttime, because then they become depressed because they have nothing to do. So they always make sure to go out at night. People's greatest fear is to be alone with nothing to do. The only way a person can be happy is if they have the capacity to utilize their energy. And that's why the Torah teaches us that, and King Solomon teaches us as well, in Ecclesiastes actually, that you must from early on learn to channel that energy from the instinctual into the world of ideas and knowledge. If you do that, then you'll have an outlet for your energy and you'll always be able to enjoy life. That is the greatest enjoyment in life. Channel that energy to the world of thought, to the world of Torah thought, to the world of ideas, and ultimately, of course, to the knowledge of God. So that's why he says in Ecclesiastes that you must remember God in your youth, because you have to start that process if you want to have a happy life. But whenever a person starts it, it's always good. It's never proper for a person to say, well, I'm too old, I'm not going to do it. You could always do it. But the earlier one starts, the better chance they have. So this is an essential part of his answer: to recognize wisdom and knowledge, to love it, to be awed by it, to be attracted to it, and to utilize one's energies in that manner. That's when the soul is in harmony, because all the energies are drawn from the instinctual into the world of wisdom and knowledge, and they're satisfied over there, and that's what gives the person happiness. But, of course, he is not finished, because there are certain threads that are still loose here that he hasn't really taken care of. And I would like to take up those points now. You take a look at 8:15, okay, where he says, "And I praise happiness, because there is no good for man under the sun but to eat and to drink and to be happy." Okay? Now, over here, again, this is a contradiction to what I said before, that happiness does nothing for a person. But what he's saying over here is, in the context of his answer, he's saying like this, that a person should not live for big goals. There's no big goals out there. The big goals out there are all illusions. Greatness, success, all these things are illusions. A person should live for the enjoyment and the beauty of knowledge, and they should enjoy, be able to enjoy the temporary and the immediate. That's an extremely great attribute, that a person can enjoy. The great scholar is an individual who is capable of enjoying the moment as well, okay? And he doesn't have the depression that follows from the person who is hedonistic. See, the hedonist has a depression, because the hedonist really is trying to get everything out of eating and drinking. But that's not possible, so after his enjoyments are over, he's in depression, because he feels, what did I get? What did I gain? But the perfected individual channels most of their energy into the world of thought and knowledge, and that which remains, they enjoy the moment. They enjoy food, they enjoy the drink, they enjoy momentary pleasures, and this is considered a great thing in the eyes of in the Torah system. A person that cannot enjoy himself, the Jerusalem Talmud says, is considered basically sick. I mean, a distorted individual, an unhealthy individual. The great scholars of Israel were always able to enjoy the moment. The Talmud says that when they used to go to a certain place where the fruits were very delicious, they used to enjoy eating the fruits, and they would enjoy a certain amount of wine, which is considered good. The momentary enjoyments of life were attainable to the great scholars because they recognized what those moments are. They're just moments. They're not something you can't, if you're going to put all your energy into that, you're going to wind up into depression. If all your energy, most of your energy, is in the area of wisdom and knowledge, then as a side dish, as a complement to that life, the little pleasures of life are something which one should enjoy. And if one doesn't enjoy them, then it shows you there's something wrong with the way with their way of living. Okay? And this really is a model, a Torah model of a personality, which, again, is not to be found in the religious sphere. Torah is unique in its system, and this concept that a person should enjoy the moment, that's the idea of enjoying wine and enjoying good food, that's what he's saying. He's saying the only thing that's good for man is to be happy and joyous and to eat and to drink. He means not, as he said before, as an essence, but as a complement to the good life. The good life demands that a person should be able to enjoy the moment, momentary enjoyment. That's what he's saying over here. Okay, that's a component of the good life, and it's actually a sign of the good life. The person who has the life of Torah can enjoy himself, and this is a characteristic of his life. Okay. Now here we come to something that is another important component of the good life. You have to put it together piecemeal. Okay, he says, and again, it's in 9:7, okay? He says, "Go and eat your bread with happiness and drink your wine with a good heart, because God has accepted your actions." Okay, now this is a very important verse. It sounds like a continuation of what he said before, And it's true in a sense, because he's saying that you should don't put stock into these illusory kind of lifestyles, the great empire builders, you know, the hedonistic life. Don't, none of those things work. But he's saying like this, enjoy your bread, enjoy your wine, drink your wine, have momentary enjoyment. He says, because God has accepted your actions. What he means is like this. You see, one of the things that he didn't handle up to this point is the need that a person has for a kind of a stamp of approval on his life. Every person has that. You see, up till now he's telling you, what he's telling us up to now is to go for the big stuff, the main thing, the attraction to knowledge, the enjoyment of knowledge. Okay, then he has the complementary enjoyments. But there still is one part of man that's not satisfied up to this point. And that part of man is a person cannot help but think about himself or herself. It's impossible not to do that. Most people are really self-absorbed. That he's against. Because when a person's interested in knowledge, you're not thinking about the self. You're thinking about when Newton is thinking about gravity and equations, he's not thinking about himself, and that's why he's happy. The happy man is the man that's out there looking at knowledge. He's not looking at himself. He's away from the self. He's into something outside of himself. Okay? This is the idea of the Torah life. Our life and our society, in contradistinction, is totally self-absorbed. People want to enjoy life. What they want to do is enjoy thinking about themselves. That, King Solomon shows, is an impossibility. Cannot be done. You can never be happy that way. So happiness is going into wisdom, which is going away from yourself. Okay? The scholar, the Talmudic scholar, is interested in solving the questions and the difficulties in the Talmud and in the Halacha. This is what his mind is preoccupied with. The problems, you know, questions. He's in the world of problem solving, the thought world, not into himself. He knows, on the contrary, he tries to avoid thinking about himself. But what King Solomon says is, you cannot deny the fact that at some point, I don't care what kind of a scholar you are, you have to think about yourself and think, you know, and a person wants some kind of approval for his lifestyle. Where do most people look for that approval? They look to their fellow man. That's where they try to get their approval. From their family, their friends, the society, and depending on the individual's need for this kind of approval, the circle will be determined. Some people are happy with a small circle. Sometimes one person can be an individual's whole world. All they need is the approval of that one person. Sometimes, most of the time, it's not enough. You need a few people. You need family, friends, recognition, and it goes to the point where people want worldwide recognition. Okay? A person has a need for recognition. Now, what do you do with that? That, if you're going to look for that, you're going to get caught again in one of his illusions because you're going to put in a lot of effort. It doesn't happen. When it does happen, it still doesn't give you the satisfaction. It's just a momentary satisfaction, and then afterwards you have the letdown. So that kind of a life is really a life of contradiction and strife. So that is not a good life. So how do you get that satisfaction in King Solomon's life? So there he says, there is only one way that a person can get that satisfaction of the stamp of approval, and it's not from man. And that is, when he lives the correct life, he knows that God approves of that life. That's his approval. And that's where he satisfies that need of man to reflect upon the self and to have the approval. That has to be satisfied in man in order to round off the happy life. But what he says is, it must only be satisfied by the knowledge that God, the source of all existence, knows that the life you're living is the correct one. Nothing else. If it's man, then you're in trouble. Now, you have to know this is a very tricky thing because many people claim that they really are interested only in God's approval, but they really are interested in man's approval. So this is, it's kind of tricky. And there's a lot of deceit, especially a person fooling himself in that respect. I mean, all the religious movements where they try to convert other people to their beliefs and all the atrocities and the horrors that have been done in the name of religion in order to get other people to convert to their beliefs is nothing more than the need for approval, recognition, the stamp of approval from another man. Because if they know that their life is the correct one before God, then they don't really need anything else. But they don't really believe that. They say that, but what they really want is the approval of man that their life is correct, and that's why they will coerce others to accept their religious beliefs, and when they're unsuccessful, they're unhappy because they don't have the approval of man. And their belief system is shaky and insecure, and the only way they can get out of that insecurity is by having other people accept their beliefs. As long as there are other beliefs which contradict theirs, they are insecure. So I just want to make the point that this is an in-depth psychology, which means that what he is saying is that you must be satisfied. But in truth, the only thing that should satisfy a person is the knowledge that God knows that I am living the correct life. There's no need for anything else. Once you have that, that's what he says, God has accepted. Go eat your bread with happiness and drink your wine with a good heart. Because you know that God knows that the life that you're living is the correct one. And that's all you need. You don't need people or anything. And if this is all you have in life, you have everything. Okay, so that is the answer to the question of what do you do with the approval needs of man. Okay? Now, there is one more thing, which I'll take up tonight, which is extremely important. And that is, it follows through from this, tied to this in a way, that's 9-9. And over here he says, see life, meaning see your life, to be with the woman that you love all the days of your empty life. I'm going to explain to you what that means. Which he gave you under the sun, all the days of your emptiness, because this is your portion in life and in your work, which you work under the sun. Okay? Very difficult, contradictory sentence on the surface. Okay. Let's take, what is the main advice he's giving? He says, see your life with the woman that you love. What is this woman that you love? So again, as I told you before, the woman is always either the instinctual life or Torah. One or the other. Because they're closely related in terms of the psychological process of the way the energies of the human mind are dispersed. So, what he says is like this. He says that over here, the good woman he's talking about, which is Torah, he says, make sure that you have life with the woman that you love, which means the Torah. Okay. Now I'm going to give the rabbinical interpretation of this. The rabbinical interpretation is that the word life over here means a means of life, which means making a living. And the word Isha, the woman that you love, is referring to Torah. And the other rabbis say that what King Solomon is teaching you is make sure that you could make a living, you can earn a living together with the woman that you love, means with Torah. In other words, Torah alone is not going to be enough. If you study, if you only have Torah, but you don't have a life, which means the physical means for life, which is earning the ability to earn a living, then you are not going to be successful. Okay? And this is a very important principle of Torah. The principle of Torah is that a person should be self-supporting, self-sufficient financially. Sounds like a mundane kind of thing. Like, really, why should that be a part of our religion, such an important part of our religion? It turns out it's one of the most important parts of our religion. That in Torah, one of the most important things is that a person should be self-sufficient, should be able to earn a livelihood. Doesn't have to be wealthy, and he doesn't have to amass large amounts of money, but he must be able to be self-sufficient and independent, which means he must know how to earn a living. A trade, a profession, whatever way it might be, but he must know how to do that, and he must spend time learning the skills of how to do that. Why is that so important? It's extremely important in Torah, because in Torah, if you take money from someone, it's not simply money you're taking from someone, but you must always desire the approval of that person. And not only do you desire that person's approval, but that person, since that person is giving you sustenance, which is really your life, and you're dependent on that person for your life, you must always be thinking in terms of how that person thinks, whether it's ethical issues, religious issues, any kind of thought that it might be, you're going to have to be concerned about him. You may have to lie to him. You may have to agree with him. You're not going to be a free agent anymore when it comes to the value system, the true value system of life. That's why the Torah demands, and this is one of the big principles of the rabbis, is that a person should be able to earn his own living. If you can't, if you're not financial, the financial is extremely important, because financial means it is very tied to, you see, in the early part of human life, the person is in need of sustenance, and the parents give the child sustenance. It's a matter of life and death, okay? Earning a living is, in a person's mind, a matter of life and death. Your life, if you depend on another person, that means that you're not looking to God anymore, you're looking to this person. You're not a free agent, okay? You'll notice in the Torah, all the leaders of Torah were always independent. Moses said, I didn't take one of their donkeys. And the rabbis say, even when he had to go on a mission for their good, he still wouldn't even borrow a donkey. He was not paid by the people. He was self-sufficient. He was independently wealthy. And the rabbis say the prophets were all wealthy. They were independent people. And the reason is because, and when Moses chose the people also, they had to be men of means. They had to be self-sufficient financially. Because if you're not self-sufficient financially, that means you must look to man for your livelihood and for your life, essentially, then you're not a free agent anymore. So the Maimonides says that the rabbis went so far as not even to take a gift from anyone, because they never wanted to feel that any human being plays a role in their physical existence. It's only God, okay? That's extremely important. And if you remember in Samuel, before Samuel rebuked the people, he said to them, just like Moses did, he says, and now I want you before all of you, I want you to give testimony. Did I ever take anything from you? Did I ever borrow anything? Did I ever not? He said, I want you to, anyone that says that I did, testify right now. And then he rebuked them, because he knew that the people, if people are supporting you, they cannot really respect you, because they feel that you're a bored individual. And for the person himself...
Rabbi, we have 1 minute.
Okay. And for the person himself, it is also an impossibility to be fair-minded and just. Of course, in today's society, we don't really live up to the ideal of the Torah in terms of leadership, and that's why we have so few true decisions in Torah, because people, our own leaders, are being supported by others, and they aren't free agents anymore. We're certainly not on the level of what the Torah really demands. Sometimes you can't help it. Sometimes it's the best you could do. So it's the best of the worst situation. But we should realize that what the best situation is, even if we're not up to that situation. Okay, we'll stop.